He told her that they would take the boy with him and nurse him as they traveled, and she gave them a vial of medicine, which might have only been arrack and water or something else, something which would save Billy, but Mackenzie did not know which. They laid Billy in the boat and cast off on the slow-running river. They gave him the golden candlestick to cradle in his arms, as a child would cradle a loved toy to soothe him to sleep. Chapter 55. Queen of the Islands. The ship left Plymouth at the beginning of August. It shuddered and rolled through the early summer storms of Biscay and came into calmer waters off the coast of Portugal, where it took on more passengers and supplies before pressing upon the vast and empty seas that broke on the shore of Africa. After numberless weeks or days counted at approximately 80 to 90, in a world where everything was approximate and at the mercy of the wind, it would or might reach its destination, which was Australia. One of its ports of call was Singapore. It was an old three-masted brig, the Queen of the Islands, carrying English and Scottish emigrants who had decided to exchange the quotidian for the unknown, and who carried with them all that they wished to salvage from their former lives, which was not much. Many were burdened with babies, both weaned and unweaned, some nurtured with precious care, and some hauled around carelessly like unnecessary luggage, as though they were not really wanted on the voyage and not expected to survive the journey. Already before the coast of France was gone from sight, one baby had died when its mother was too seasick to produce milk for it. The little body was wrapped in sacking and sent sliding down a plank into the ocean. The human parcel was so light, it floated obstinately on the waves for a good few seconds before the water reared up in a sudden sweep of shimmering green and drew it under. There were also convicts on board. They were housed in darkness, in the space where seamen called tween decks, below the waterline of the ship, and they were almost never permitted, it seemed, to come up into the light, to breathe fresh air. It was said that you could travel on this journey and never see them. For their crimes, they'd been placed in a shadowy region where none but they would ever be found. But sometimes, as you climbed down towards the bowels of the Queen, you could hear the sound of hammering, as though these unhappy people had been put to keep building and repairing the ship even as it sailed on. Mostly Valentine Ross kept to his cabin. Remembering the hutch he had been shown aboard the Rainsford, he was grateful that in this dark little space on the berthing deck of the Queen of the Islands he could at least stand upright. The bunk where he was to spend so many uncountable nights was hard and narrow, but there was at least a straw palliasse upon it and a pillow, which might once have been plump with feathers, but which now resembled a slab of pastry dough. Ross had stowed his few possessions, which included a pharmacopoeia containing tincture of Jesuit's bark for fever and guaiacum for syphilis, as well as opium, mercury, and arsenic, in a sea chest, which also served as a table. In this materia medica resided Valentine Ross's one frail hope of a future. He spent much time on his knees, in a slumped attitude oddly resembling prayer, staring at the bottles and vials. With these, he thought, he might possess the power to rescue his brother from whatever maladies had befallen him. And if he could do this, then his life would not remain the futile thing that it now appeared to him, a life of empty yearning, failed endeavor, and sudden, unanticipated cruelty. It would take wing again. He would have saved a beautiful soul. He also carried with him the ransom letter from Raja Leon. He had read it so many times that the paper was cracked and faded, but no money had been sent. Valentine Ross had convinced himself its writer was a blackmailer and a liar. Indeed, he was disposed to believe that almost everybody in the world was set upon a pathway of lies. People thought only of their own pleasures and satisfactions and were empty of compassion. After the great ship had ploughed the furrows of Biscay, and the wind had subsided, Ross was surprised to be woken on a dark dawn by a man, bringing him fresh water in a tin jug, a sliver of soap, and a frayed grey towel. The person was elderly and stooped, perhaps from a life spent tween decks, but with a face oddly etched with mirth and a voice of surprising gentleness. he announced himself as a servant to the naval officer type class of passenger. In other words, to those who lodged on the upper berthing decks. He apologized to Ross for having neglected my duties to you, sir, on account of being stricken with the emetics. Ross regarded him from the safety of his bunk, unwilling to engage in any discourse and sternly disliking the idea that he was about to be burdened with a servant who might disturb his solitude at inappropriate moments upon some irritating whim of the ship's timetable and its infernal ringing of bells. He therefore said nothing. The servant appeared untroubled by this. He poured the water into a canvas bowl set on a gimbal to try and keep the liquor from splashing out side to side with the roll of the ship and announced, "My name is Chesterfield, and it's often remarked that I share a designation with a piece of furniture. You're quite free to comment in your fashion upon this, but I must tell you I'm unmoved by it, for Chesterfield is a comfortable thing, bringing respite to the body, and what is a servant, sir, but a useful object upon which people may depend? I think my name is very fitting." Ross felt too tired and irritated to make any observation upon this. After a moment he said, "I do not need a servant. I can fetch my own fresh water. I wish to be left entirely alone." Chesterfield turned, wiping his eyes with the ragged towel, quite as if he was overcome by tears at being told that he was unnecessary. Then, without saying a word, but with the shadow of a smile on his amused countenance, he placed the soap and towel beside the water bowl and went out. When he had gone, Ross sighed, closed his eyes, and returned to sleep. After just a few days at sea, Ross understood that the voyage had put him into a state of limbo. The ship made its difficult way through the Atlantic, but for him there was no feeling of being carried onwards, but only of being in some waiting room where the wind howled so loudly in the walls that he was becoming deaf. In this place, the present had no structure or purpose. His mind was drenched perpetually in memories of the past. He told himself that if he were to engage his fellow passengers in conversation and learn something of their lives, he might be able to inhabit the days and nights with better grace. But he could not force himself to do this. Sunk so deeply into his own agonies, his head down, arms folded and pressed against his chest, he knew he appeared almost as a madman might appear. On the rare occasions when he walked about the decks or took a meal at a communal table, he saw what he created in people's hearts, a feeling of unease. It was as if they feared he might do them harm, and a part of him believed that they were right to fear this, because he could no longer accurately judge what he was capable of doing or saying. When asked what he did for a profession, not wishing to risk having his doctor skills called upon during the voyage, he told his fellow passengers that he was an archaeologist. He invented a site on one of the hills surrounding Bath where a Saxon burial pit was supposedly being unearthed. And he found, as he anticipated, that nobody was truly interested in a past so distant from them. They had left England and its violent history behind them. They didn't want to think about slain bodies and axe heads of stone. They were going to the New World, which perhaps they imagined as a place of untouched vacancy, where history had never made landfall, where they would hold untroubled sway for the rest of their lives. For Ross, the past was his only real habitation, yet it felt as though it had unfixed itself from any irrefutable truth and become fluid, offering him different versions of events he had thought would remain stable forever. When he remembered, for instance, the day in boarding school when he saved Edmund from his bullying peers by grabbing the tallest of the persecuting boys and holding him out of the dormitory by his feet, he was now not certain whether he had not let go of the child and watched the body fall. It seemed to him that he remembered a falling. He could now believe that he had seen the boy on the ground, his neck broken. He could hear some loud commotion before he himself was grabbed by the arms and led away. Led away where? It could not have unfolded like this because he, Ross, would have had to endure the fiercest punishment, and there was no punishment. Only this memory of the boy lying on the grass and the sound of people's fear. And it came to him that what he was imagining was what he now knew himself to have been capable of, not what he actually did. If he was a person who was capable of letting a 12-year-old boy fall to his death from a window, was he also capable of murdering the woman he loved? He learned a little of the ship's lore. Ropes were sheets, sails were shrouds, wooden berths had the narrowness of coffins. All he noted was being made ready for death. For death was everywhere. It kept climbing towards the queen of the islands, in the unceasing purpose of the waves and hurling themselves upon the vessel to break over the gunwales. The sea and the wind waged never-ending war with the old brig, and this struck Ross as a wretched state of affairs, that the elements on which the ship depended for its journey appeared perpetually intent on its destruction. He asked himself if he would mind dying, and recognized that in some obstinate part of himself, he was made angry by the idea that his life could end at the age of 32. Yet what really was left to him? What could he find to fill up all the years that might lie in store? If Edmund's life could be saved by him, then at least there was an honor in that and a real manifestation of the brotherly love he had never ceased to feel. But afterwards, what would remain to him? Would he sink into the debauch and inertia that tropical climates could bring about in white men who have lost their sense of purpose and resolve? Would it not be better to stuff his pockets with some leaden object lying about the cluttered decks of the Queen of the Islands and say to the heartless ocean, "Take me into your dread deep, for I have earned nothing better"? Of Jane, he tried not to think. He wanted to sweep the past clean of her, as though she had never existed, and that part of him which loved her with such violent force had never existed either. But she was so mighty a presence still in his imagination that she couldn't be erased. Her tall shadow seemed to follow him wherever he went and whatever he did. He saw her at the assembly rooms in her red dress, wearing a feather in her hair. He saw her at the baths, ghostly in her white gown, as the sick and dying reached out to her. He saw her lying naked in his bed. He asked himself what was to be done to banish her from his mind, knowing that until this was achieved, he would live a half-life, the pathetic life of a solitary mourner. He tried reenacting his punishment of her, pounding her skull against the wall, letting her fall on the stairs left for dead. But these imaginings weren't sufficient to rid himself of her, for he was unable to believe that he had had the power to take her life. She lived still, didn't she? Couldn't he feel her stubborn head nudging against his heart? Chapter 56. Vigil. When Jane had fallen against the wall, the fetus inside her, a tiny sack of half-made flesh, which had clung to her womb for 5 weeks, began to break from its mooring. After contractions which felt as though they were splitting her body in two, it was ejected out of her and washed across the hallway by a blood tide which seemed to have no ebb. Julietta and Nancy tried to staunch the terrifying deluge with soft towels pressed against and inside Jane's vagina, but by the time the doctor arrived, Jane's face had lost all its color, and her hands and feet were as cold as marble. She drifted in and out of consciousness. The throbbing in her head where it had been struck against the wall seemed to her to make a strange echoing answer to the agony in her womb. She could feel blood sliding down her neck, but she understood that this wound was invisible as yet in her hair. When she tried to cry out to Julietta that her skull had been bruised, she found that she couldn't speak. The doctor carried her to the bedroom that had once been Emmeline's and laid her down on the wide bed. He placed pillows under her knees to raise her legs in a vain attempt to stop the blood that was still flowing out of her. He ordered Julietta and Nancy to fetch furs and blankets to try and warm her. Aware now of her head wound, he got Jane to swallow a little laudanum. He saw that her lips were blue and her whole body was trembling. He spoke to her softly. He informed her that his name was Dr. Wood. Then he told her what she already knew, that she had lost her child. Her large eyes stared up at him, but barely flickered. The doctor waited for her to say something, but she did not seem to be able to make any answer. Dr. Wood examined Jane's head and found a flesh wound and livid bruising, but no cracks in the skull that he could detect. He cut away some locks of Jane's hair matted with blood, which he put into an enamel dish. He then gently cleaned the wound with carbolic acid, laid over it a piece of lint soaked in carbolic oil, and wound bandages in a tight helmet round her head. He saw her eyes close. He pulled a chair close to the bed and waited. After taking the laudanum, Jane could remember very little. She told herself that she had to try to keep breathing, but it seemed to her that she'd been transported into a grey wilderness where the air was so cold that she did not dare to inhale it. She found that she was swaddled in fur, and the perfume of the fur was strangely familiar to her, and this gave her hope that she wasn't alone in the wasteland she now inhabited. She reasoned that she might be among people who would know how to build shelters out of blocks of snow, and that soon she might find herself carried into one of these and made warm again. But this didn't happen. In spite of the fur, her whole body was convulsing with cold. She fancied she could hear the noise her bones made as they shook in their sockets, like the wooden bones of a puppet. And then she could no longer hear anything. She entered a tunnel of silence. It was black night in the tunnel, but a long way away she could see a tiny circle of light. She stared at this, not sure how she should interpret it. She knew she was moving very slowly towards it, but there was nothing to tell her whether it was the light of heaven or the light shining on some human shore. At the bedside, Julietta had reached for Jane's hand under the furs and kept rubbing it to try and warm it, then laid it against her cheek and kissed it and shed hot tears upon it. She saw the doctor staring at her when she did this, but she cared nothing for what he thought. She had sent Nancy to run to Tedworth Square to bring Ashton to her side. She herself was still shaking from the violence Valentine Ross had inflicted and was frightened that the wretched fiancé might decide to return. The household needed Ashton's protection. But more than this, if Julietta was going to lose Jane, she wanted the dear comfort of her husband, and she had no doubt that he would give it. Whatever he knew or did not know about the erotic bond between the two women, his love for Julietta brought everything into the shelter of his forgiveness and acceptance. Moreover, she knew that he admired Jane for her dedication to her work and for her wit. If she was now dying, Ashton Sims would wish to bear witness to that death. While waiting for him to arrive, Julietta, speaking in a low voice, fearing to wake Jane from a sleep that might be beneficial to her, asked Dr. Wood if he'd lost patients before who had miscarried. He replied that he had, and in this case too there had been a fall and a hemorrhage which could not be staunched. "It is," he said, "a sad reflection on the state of medical knowledge that we know so much about bloodletting that we do not know how, under certain circumstances, to make the flow stop. We just have to trust to nature."
"What more can we do?"
asked Julietta.
"Administer more laudanum presently. It lessens the shock of the pain, and the brandy is a stimulus, which perhaps encourages new blood to form. But the next few hours will be telling. She will either be gone by nightfall or the bleeding will stop and she will begin a slow recovery."
Silence then filled the room again. Jane's breathing was so quiet, it reminded Julietta of the breathing of a child. And thoughts of her little Marco, alive and bounding about his nursery, filled her with sudden joy. And she thought how Jane would never know this happiness now, of loving a child. The bits and pieces of her baby's half-formed body had been strewn across the hall. The husband-to-be would never be allowed to return. These thoughts led in turn to a decision in Julietta Sims, which she never thought she would be able to make. If God would spare Jane a Dean, she would renounce her beauties. She cared nothing for them, only for the excitement of the showy orgasms she alone was able to give them. Henceforth, she would love only two people, Jane and Ashton. She would bring Ashton more frequently to her bed so that they might conceive another child, a child whom Jane could know from its babyhood and grow to love, along with its adoring parents.
In this arrangement, provided she could still have Jane as her lover, she saw a beautiful triangular domestic felicity. Ashton came in and said good day to Dr. Wood, then stood and looked down at Jane's head protruding from its mound of furs and bound like an Egyptian mummy with her white bandages. Nancy brought in a chair for him, and he too reached out for Jane's cold hand and held it, so that he and Julietta seemed to play the role of her keepers, and they hoped that they were leading her not towards death's prison, but towards a resumption of her life. All night they stayed like this, barely moving. In the early hours, Dr. Wood departed, leaving the laudanum jar by the bedside and promising to return at midday. Nancy showed the doctor out and then came back to the hall, where she had had to sluice away Jane's blood with her mop and scoop up the broken fetus in her bare hands. Now she wept for the tiny embryo she had tipped into the night soil bucket. Then she washed herself and changed her clothes and made coffee on the range and took this up to Ashton and Julietta, who were talking about the terrible events of the afternoon in soft voices, while outside the chimes of Old St. Peter's Church tolled the hours. Towards morning, Julietta went down into the hall and stared up at the damaged portrait torn at the very center of the picture. Pieces of the canvas hung down, revealing the wall behind, and Julietta was disturbed to see that it was in fact the area of Jane's womb which had been destroyed. And it shocked her to realize that Valentine Ross, wherever he had fled, might live the rest of his life never knowing that he'd murdered his own child. Chapter 57. A State of Marvelous Dreaming. Knowing nothing of all this, Clorinda Morrissey was in Dublin. Word had reached her that her niece Moira had succumbed, despite the expensive interventions of the Dublin surgeons, and had been laid to rest in the little cemetery at the end of Bishop Street, where, in the autumn, the rowan trees shed a carpet of orange berries onto the graves. Michael Morrissey wrote to Clorinda that the thyroid gland, once removed from poor Moira's body, may have caused her other organs to act wrongfully, being turned against their proper functions, so that she and we endured distress beyond your imagining. Clorinda wished to reply that nothing was beyond her imagining. She had lived through the famine. She had seen the Liffey freighted with dead bodies. She had seen the stomachs of babies burst from the gas of starvation. But she knew also that now her quarrel with Michael had to end. He had lost one of his beloved girls. She would have to show mercy towards him no matter what it cost her. She found him and his wife Kathleen in a state of dumb sorrow. Michael was unable to go to work at the Anchor Brewery, he told her, because my legs just won't carry me there. He sat all day by the smoky fire in the parlour, ladling on coal, watching the blue and yellow of the flames, choking on the smoke, spitting phlegm onto the dusty floor. Kathleen sat near him, playing with a pack of tarot cards, whose predictions she did not fully understand, swearing at the figures as she turned them up. All around her, disorder accumulated. Unwashed crockery stood about in piles. Dirty clothes and bedding lay soaking in tin pails, never washed nor hung out to dry. Behind the chicken wire of the larger door, bread grew a patina of blue mold, and potatoes put forth fibrous green shoots, quite as though the overheated air was thickening itself into earth. Worst of all, Clorinda saw, was the state of the other child, the younger child, Aisling. It was as though Michael and Kathleen had forgotten her existence, or if they remembered it, treated it as though they had no obligation towards her. Aisling was 11 years old but refused to go to school, and the parents were too indifferent, it seemed, to care about this. They just sent her out into the cold street to play on her own or with the toddlers who staggered about the road chasing rats and squirrels, sitting down in puddles and laughing with woe. When she was allowed back into the apartment, she went to her mother and father each in turn, hoping to be hugged by them. And they held her to them for a brief moment before they sent her to her room, the room she had once shared with the dead Moira, there to curl up on her bed with her toy pig, staring at nothing. Clorinda could not bear the look of sadness on Aisling's face. She took the pails of washing into the communal laundry room in the basement beneath the tenement house. She set the water on to boil on a blackened range. Then she came back and found carbolic soap and a washboard and took these into Aisling's room. She knelt down by the bed and took the toy pig out of the child's hand and gave her the soap. She said, "Would you like to help me perform a miracle?" In the end, Clorinda had to bribe Aisling with money. But she told herself that this did not matter. Now together they soaped and scrubbed and pounded the washing. A penny for a shirt, 2 farthings for a pair of drawers, 3 pence for a petticoat, 6 pence for a sheet. Very quickly they grew hot and their hair became wild and rebellious in the steam, but they both felt strangely enthralled by the quantity of work they had to get through, and they kept on for more than 4 hours, till most of it was clean and rinsed and hung up to dry. Their hands were red and sore. They were hungry and parched. Clorinda returned to the room where Michael and Kathleen sat unmoving, snatched up her purse and 2 bonnets, and went back to Aisling, whose pale face was now scarlet and smiling. Smoothing her own hair and that of the child, she crammed the bonnets onto their heads and led them out into the late afternoon, where a pale sun laid upon the empty street an unfamiliar glance of beauty. Clorinda found a luncheon room which sold hot pork sausages and bread rolls. She ordered a jug of milk and 4 sausages and butter for the rolls, and she and Aisling made a grand feast together, not caring if grease from sausages ran down their chins, and loving the milk, which was fresh from the herds of Kildare and full of cream. When this was done, Clorinda ordered coffee, which her niece had never tasted, then sat back and looked at Aisling. She was no beauty. Her expression tended towards sourness as well as sadness. Her complexion was blue pale and her eyes were narrow. But enlivened by the work and the food and the coffee, she appeared to Clorinda like someone who had been absent from life and was now beginning to rejoin it. With strands of dark hair escaping from her bonnet and her cheeks an excited kind of red, she was almost pretty. And Clorinda now suddenly saw how she might save her, at least for a while, from her loveless life. She began talking to Aisling about her own grandfather and the place where he had lived on the shores of County Clare opposite the Aran Islands. She said she had a longing to return there, to run on the strand, to gather pink cowrie shells, to hear the gannets calling. She then asked her niece if she would like to make the journey with her to this place and watch the sun go down over the ocean and sleep in the silence of the wind. And the girl said yes. She longed to go away from Dublin, from the rain-soaked street and the crying babies, and from the room where her mother came in at night to weep for the dead. When Michael and Kathleen protested that Clorinda couldn't take Aisling away from them, as she knew they would, she said nothing. She simply placed before Michael a bank draft, made payable to Mr. Michael Morrissey of 12 Bishop Street, accompanied by a formal note of endorsement, stating that this was the sum of money still rightly owing to him and agreed by both parties as his family share of the ruby necklace designated an appanage of the Morrissey family, and saw his face lift from its contemplation of the coals and break into a wintry smile. She did not tell him that her savings were now all spent. "Take her then," said Michael, his eyes still fixed on the satisfactory arithmetic before him on the table. "See if she likes grubbing for cockles in the sand." It was a long journey, by coach and by cart, but the weather was kind, and the feeling of travelling westwards, back towards a place where she'd been happy as a girl, enthralled Clorinda. And she saw Aisling, who'd never been out of Dublin, enter a state of marvellous dreaming at the sight of the green hills and the groves of ash and the hedgerows in summer leaf. They put up in wayside inns, where travelling salesmen seemed to be the only other guests, going from farm to farm with smudged brochures offering new steam-driven machinery that none but the rich landowners could afford. Against these men, adrift on their tides of frustration and disappointment, they locked their door at night. Clorinda was not surprised that Aisling wanted to reach out before she slept to hold her aunt's hand. She clutched it tight. She told the girl about her tea room, which had been born out of an old funeral parlour, and how death and sorrow could be conquered by visions of new things. She described the galas she'd attended in Bath, with their carousels and their fireworks, and told her about the handsome Belgian acrobat who had fallen off stilts and lain in the dust looking ridiculous. She heard Aisling laugh, and when the laughter faded, the girl said,
"That was a strange feeling. I don't think I've laughed very much in my life before, except once at a mouse that ran up the side of the bread bin and turned a somersault."
When they came to the house near Innistimon, where the grandfather had lived his solitary life, they found it occupied by a pair of sisters, the Mrs. McKinnon, creeping unobserved into middle age. One of them, Miss Elizabeth, spent her days in the old barn, painting pictures of birds and sailing ships, while the other, Miss Maeve, milked their goats, fed their chickens, and kept the house. And when these women saw Aisling, wearing her poor city clothes and with her bonnet all askew, they looked at her with longing. They had never had a child to love, and now here was an 11-year-old girl at their door who was thin and lost-seeming, and they wanted to take her in and set before her the elder Miss McKinnon's oyster pie and make a bed for her with their best linen sheets and teach her the pet names of their goats. Though Clorinda said that they would find an inn nearby in Innistimon, the McKinnon sisters, learning that their house had once belonged to Clorinda's grandfather, would not hear of them leaving. They were shown to an attic room, now furnished with a wooden bed and a painted chest of drawers and hung with Miss Elizabeth's bright pictures, and when Clorinda went in there, she remembered what it had housed in her grandfather's time. A sewing machine with an old black handle and piles of cured animal skins, from which he fashioned the tawdry coats and mufflers, which he sold to the people of Innistimon, and which kept him in silver sixpences and tobacco all through the winter. Clorinda told Aisling that she had longed for one of Grandpappy's rabbit skin coats, and he kept promising that he would make her one to keep you warm in that sinful city of Dublin. But it had never come her way. But now, as she lay in the wooden bed, holding Aisling's hand, she fancied that the smell of rabbit and fox had lingered in the attic after all these years. The perfume of the past, caught in the wainscot and in the dusty space beneath the floor. The weather held fine, and the following day Clorinda and Aisling made their way over the dunes, where samphire used to grow, down to the wide strand, to see the Atlantic tides come roaring in. At the sight and the sound of the sea, Aisling held out her arms in the manner of a flying bird and began to run in wild circles. Then she cast away her boots, held up her skirts, and pelted to where the ocean came sliding in over the sand. She let the water drench her feet, bringing her gifts of tiny stones and shells and drifts of bladder wrack. She let escape from her throat long, frozen cries of joy, and Clorinda was able to see in that instance a different girl from the one she had known in the city. It was as if the person she had been, the facial expressions she had adopted all her life, had been a mistake, a distortion of her true self, and now she had decided to become someone else. Clorinda was just beginning to blame herself for what she had done, taking her niece away from the confined existence to which in a mere few days she would have to return her, when she saw Elizabeth and Maeve McKinnon coming towards them, carrying all the paraphernalia of a picnic. They stopped and laughed with delight at the figure of Aisling communing with the sea, then began to set out the picnic. "There is elderberry cordial for the child," said Elizabeth, "and ginger beer for us, and cold mutton with relish, and lettuce from our patch."
"And apples from our ancient tree," added Maeve, "which we store all winter long in the outhouse, just as your grandfather used to do. When you and Aisling taste our apples, you may both feel that you've come home."
Chapter 58. A Man Who Disliked Riddles. Sir William hadn't accompanied Clorinda to Dublin, not only because he felt he would not be welcome in Michael Morrissey's household, but also because he knew that he had neglected his patients of late, and he was resolved to make amends to them now. No sooner had he made this resolution, however, than a letter arrived from Ashton Sims, informing him of James' suffering, apparently from a bad fall. Sir William knew that he couldn't possibly remain in Bath when something terrible had happened to his daughter. According to Sims, Jane was so very much weakened by blood loss that my wife and I fear she will not pull through, unless perhaps you come quickly to her side to save her.
Consulting his medical journals, he found scant new remedies for severe hemorrhage, only those he already knew. The exhortation to let the patient rest, the suggestion that a cocktail made from strong spirits, yolk of egg, and mustard seed could be beneficial to the body's ability to fashion blood. Red meat eaten raw was also recommended, as was the slow chewing of spinach leaves. And these things he tried on his patients, with some small success. Armed with this all too inadequate knowledge, Sir William posted a note of apology for his absence on his door, gave instructions to his nurse to do what she could for those who pleaded with her, and set forth for London. Ashton Sims had not explained to him how or why Jane had become ill, but Sir William could not but think that her indisposition had something to do with Ross, who had never returned to Bath, but had instructed his servant to send on his things to a hotel in the West Country and only sent a scrawled message to say, without any explanation, that his engagement to Jane was at an end. All of this news, together with Emmeline's recent death and Clorinda's absence in Ireland, made Sir William feel that he was suddenly bitterly alone. Running his hands through his thick grey hair, he wondered if his world was about to disintegrate into a state of sorrow he would not be able to bear. He found Jane lying in Emmeline's bed, not sleeping, but in a state of prostration, too weak almost to move her bandaged head. But when she saw her father, her pale lips did widen into a smile, and she held out a limp hand to him. He took her hand and kissed it, then sat by her, stroking a few strands of her hair back from her forehead, which was sweaty but cold, then transferring his own hand to her wrist to take her pulse. He found it to be very weak, and his practiced physician's ear and eye would have suggested to him that his daughter was near death, except that she, above everybody that he knew, was possessed of an extraordinary strength of body and will. He only wondered now if she was heartbroken by Ross's unexpected departure and wished to let go her hold on life. At present, however, he sensed that she was too weak for any intrusive interrogation. Sitting quietly in the room was a nurse engaged by Ashton Sims, so it was to her that Sir William addressed a few quiet questions. He learned that Jane had been persuaded to sip a little soup, and that she suffered from an unslakable thirst. He was also told that her consumption of laudanum for her pain was high, and that her sleep appeared to be troubled by nightmares.
"Where is the pain?" asked Sir William. "In her head?"
"Yes, sir. And in her womb, which bleeds." Now Sir William was silent. Jane, too weak to talk, gazed up at him, pleading with her eyes that he not condemn her. All this he saw, and to answer her he said,
"All that matters, Jane, is that you come back to us. To this end, I've heard some fanciful notion about the efficacy of yolks of egg and mustard seed. I wonder if our kind nurse could ask Nancy to go to one of the Chelsea markets for eggs and make a posset for you, or is that too outrageous a demand?"
Again he saw the curve of a smile on her mouth and took this for an affirmative answer. He nodded to the nurse and she went out, taking with her a water jug, which was empty, to refill it. Left alone with Jane, Sir William once again took her hand and stroked it gently. Jane closed her eyes, and Sir William saw tears begin to run down her cheek, and he knew that these tears were not only for the pain, but for the recent catastrophe. He could guess at the reasons for it, but refused to name it even to himself. He only sensed that there was a finality about it which, even if Jane survived, would bring about an alteration to their lives, and that nothing in the future would be as he had once counted upon it being. When the nurse returned, Sir William said to Jane,
"I am going to ask her to lift the bedclothes and examine you, to see whether you are still bleeding. Are you happy that she should do this?"
To Sir William's surprise, Jane turned her head to him and whispered the word, "portrait." He did not know if he had heard her correctly, and raised his head to silently interrogate the nurse. For a moment she looked away, unwilling to make any answer, but then she said quietly, "The portrait of Miss Jane has been taken down and returned to the late Miss Emmeline's studio. Mr. Sims told me to tell you when you arrived that you might wish to look at it."
Sir William Adeen was a man who disliked riddles. In his own profession, when diagnosis was difficult, it put him into a mild state of anguish, and this is what he felt now. Anguish on top of anguish, that his daughter was holding to life by a frayed thread, and that he was being sent upon some quest which might only increase this confusion. He nevertheless stood up obediently, and reassuring Jane that he would be back directly, went out and down the stairs towards his sister's studio, a room which had always engendered strong feelings in him, feelings of both admiration and fear. He had never been told the story of the golem, never known that Emmeline had suffered quite so cruelly at the hands of Jocelyn Halton. But he had often been afraid for his sister, for her vulnerability in a man's world and for her loneliness. He had sometimes seen her life as a kind of martyrdom to her art, and had never been able to decide if the sacrifice was worth the sorrow. Now, as he walked towards the studio, he heard a ring at the doorbell, and Nancy came out of the kitchen to answer it. Sir William waited at the foot of the stairs. The door opened to admit Ashton and Julietta Sims, and when Julietta saw Jane's father, she rushed to him and asked, "How is she, Sir William? Has she rallied? Is she out of danger?"
"I cannot say," said Sir William, "but I do not think the danger is past. And now she has asked me to go look at her portrait."
"Oh, the portrait, the portrait," cried Julietta. "Oh, Sir William, it will tell you the whole terrible story. But Ashton, dearest, why do you and Sir William not go and sip a glass of claret in the drawing room, and then everything can be made plain by that means, man to man?"
If there was a momentary look of terror on Ashton Sims' face, he quickly mastered himself, nodded to Sir William and said,
"Probably that is best, that nothing is hidden from you. We believe it's what Jane wishes."
"I must go to Jane," said Julietta. "I must go at once, poor darling, poor angel."
And she fled up the stairs, leaving the two men marveling at the effortless speed with which she'd rushed towards her friend. If it was difficult at this time for men who did not know each other well to bring themselves to speak frankly about intimate matters, it was also the case that Ashton Sims, whose friends were writers, publishers, artists, and moral philosophers of the day, was used to discussing all the exquisite agonies afflicting the human condition. Thus, to relate to Jane's father the story of her pregnancy and cruel miscarriage, and its fearful cause, was not as painful to him as it would have been for almost anyone else. He was able to tell the tale calmly and slowly, and yet even he could not tell it truthfully. About Ross's motive for hurting Jane, he had had to speculate only that Jane's fiancé had believed himself betrayed in some way. He could not bring himself to admit to Sir William Adeen that the cause of the man's violent outburst had been the knowledge that his own wife was Jane's lover. Sir William, then, was left with the story as if told by an author who disdains to apportion to his characters reason and motive. And when he saw that this was how things would remain, he felt again his habitual impatience with the arrival of yet another riddle. But he also saw that Ashton Sims had gone as far with his dreadful tale as he was able to go at present. Sir William lit a cigar to calm himself and said,
"Poor wretched Ross, I still cannot see how he arrived at such a crime."
He puffed on his cigar for some moments, then he added,
"I believe he may finally have gone in search of his brother on the Malay archipelago. I think we will never set eyes on him again."
"Ah," said Ashton.
"Well, perhaps that is for the best."
Chapter 59, The White Cloud. She could not rid herself of the feeling that she was drowning. It wasn't that the water choked her. It was the coldness of the sea in her veins. It coursed all through her, entering and leaving her heart, slowly insinuating itself into her brain, depositing ice crystals there, and the crystals flashed with wounding light. Jane Adeen. She could remember her name. She could breathe its syllables still, but she did not know how long the name would last. It seemed to her that it had begun to flicker and dim, and that when at last her name went dark, then her life would be lost. In the frozen world she now inhabited, she remembered thinking of herself as her own lifeboat in her great tallness, Perhaps she'd even boasted about this, that in some way her height set her apart from everybody else and would never let her drown. Yet now she knew that the freezing water would soon close over her head. Images of her past rose up like faithful ghosts to keep her company for a while and then faded away. She saw the beautiful symmetries of the baths and herself as their angel, keeping watch as the trusting people, the smaller people, floundered in the sulfurous water, all their movements impotent and slow, but their faces turned upwards towards her, begging for mercy, trusting her to save them. Yet it seemed that she could not save them, for when she next saw them, they were in the Paris morgue, set out for show on marble slabs, with water pouring into their closed eyes and out of their mouths and from between their legs to rush past their feet and be sucked into the vortex of a metal drain. She saw Marco. The little boy was swimming in the baths, swimming without fear, not asking anything of her, but travelling round and round, merrily splashing, and she hoped that this vision would last and keep her company for a while. She tried to remain still, to stop herself from shivering, so that Marco would stay as he was, buoyant in his life, destined to go on and grow into a man. But then the vapor rising from the hot bath began to grow dense. It formed itself into a white cloud around Marco, and though Jane searched and searched, she could no longer see him. So then it seemed to her that if Marco was gone and the cloud obscuring him appeared to be growing larger and larger, it would soon engulf her too, and then her end would be reached at last. She remembered that for most of her life, she had had the notion of some momentous thing towards which she was traveling. She had thought of it as something which would bring her happiness and renown. But now she understood that the thing was death. It was within her reach. In moments it would come. But she allowed herself one last thought about her own foolishness, walking through life so tall and blithe, convinced that some grand destiny awaited her, when all the time she had merely been striding towards oblivion. It almost made her laugh. The angel of the baths, wearing her white robes, so convinced of her singularity and her power, obliterated by a white cloud, impotent to save herself from joining the manufacturer of glue and all other flawed and decadent people on their journey to nothingness. Nearer and nearer came the cloud. Jane tried to retreat from it, but found herself up against a stone wall. So then she knew that what was asked of her was surrender. She closed her eyes. She waited for her own invisibility, but knew still that she was unreconciled to it. Something of her old pride and stubbornness kept surfacing in her. It understood that all was lost, and yet it still fought on. Then, with her very last ounce of rebellion, a rebellion worthy of Emmeline, going forth into the world wearing a jeweled turban, a rebellion worthy of an exhausted washerwoman who believes that the moonlight will blanch her laundered sheets, she opened her eyes again. Cloud hung near, but something moved within it. It was a small shape, no larger than a child's bundle of washing, but then it seemed to take form and color, and began to dance, waving its arms in the air, and Jane knew then it was going to step out of the cloud and save her life. It was the clay golem, and it came forth gleaming and soft, as if fresh from the pottery wheel. Jane woke to find Juliet at her bedside. She woke too to more words than she had had within her for a long time. She said Juliet's name and was able to reach out to her with both arms, and Juliet held her and realized that Jane's body was no longer cold as it had been. She kissed her forehead and then laid her head on Jane's breast. She wanted to call out to Ashton and to Sir William that Jane was returning to them, but was so held by the moment that she could find no voice. It was Jane who began to speak. She said, "I have had visions. I saw death as a cloud, and it was coming towards me." "Hush, dearest," said Julietta. "Don't talk of any death cloud. Feel how warm is your face and your hand and your breast. Are they warm? Feel." Jane reached up and put her hand on her cheek, and she understood she would now get well again and rejoin the world.
Yes, she said. Yes, they are warm.
She could only lie still and gaze in wonder at the soft and comforting light in the room, at some roses arranged in a white vase on a little table now beginning to shed their petals. Then she brought her eyes to the things she longed to see above all others, Giulietta's face. Chapter 60, The Good Shepherd. As the Queen of the Islands heaved itself southwards towards the Atlantic storms and its passengers tried to cajole the time with plans for their new lives in Australia, Valentine Ross kept obstinately to his cabin and only walked on deck in the deep of the night when often the sea seemed to be calmer and the stars, shining more brightly than they ever did in an English sky, attempted to seduce him with some intimation of wonder. He resisted their attempt. He knew that wonder was gone from the world. He wished only to be left alone, not caring about the squalor created by his bodily existence in his cramped quarters. When his self-appointed servant Chesterfield began fussing round him, picking up dirty clothes, covering his chamber pot with a rag before taking it away, he asked the old man why he performed these tasks.
When nothing signifies, and it matters not at all to me that I should wear foul underwear or that my pot should overflow.
Chesterfield stood his ground as best he could on a tilting ship and replied,
It matters to me, sir. I'm a servant. While I am bound to this condition, I can only strive to do my duty as a servant in the way that will bring me no shame.
Shame?
Yes. You will say that it's a strong word to use, but is the right word? For if we fail in the tasks appointed to us, what is there for us but that?
Ross, who was lying on his bunk and suffering all the spinal discomfort of one who has lain there far too long, looked up at Chesterfield in surprise. He had had no stomach for any conversation with the old man. But now he had made an observation which Ross judged to be astute. He knew that he himself was mired in shame for all that he had neglected, his abject failure in love, and for his wicked moment of physical cruelty. But he was not ready to speak about it, most particularly not to one so far beneath him in the terrible hierarchy of the world. Chesterfield, however, was not done with the subject. While busying himself examining the food stains on one of Ross's cast-off shirts, he went on to say,
Now you, sir, I deduce from the contents of your oak chest that you are a doctor. Is that the case?
Yes. It is the case, but will you swear please not to put this information about the ship?
I swear I'll not put it about, sir, but I only ask you, as a medical man who has sworn an oath to do no harm, do you not in your profession wish to serve your patients as best you can?
Ross looked down at his hands. He had wished it. He had sincerely wished it. He had striven to deepen his medical knowledge as the years passed. The notion that he'd been able to relieve suffering had given him godlike satisfaction, and then, after the fateful day in Mrs. Morrissey's tea room when Jane Adine had mocked him and refused him, that wish had gradually grown feeble, and he had begun to let slip away from him his dedication to his profession. Hurt beyond endurance, he had no longer cared in the same way about trying to heal the sick and infirm. But it was not his fault. It was Jane's fault. She had rendered him indifferent towards those he should have helped. And in the end, she had cancelled out his sworn promise to do no harm. She had tortured him to the point where he wished to kill her. All this made a logical progression through Ross's mind as Chesterfield began gathering more clothes from the dirty floor. But he understood, deep in his heart's core, that he would never confess it to any living soul.
I was a good doctor, was all he said.
But you use the past tense, said Chesterfield. Why is that?
Because that is all there is, he said. In the middle of an ocean, there is only stasis. All I know is the past.
Have you no plans for when you arrive in Singapore, sir?
I will not notice Singapore. It has no meaning for me. I will only seek out some kind of native craft at the wharfs there. Prowess, I believe they are named, to convey me to Borneo.
To take up your doctoring again?
No. I go for only one reason, to save my brother.
From what, sir, if I may ask?
I do not know. Now, when you have collected sufficient laundry, please be good enough to go away and leave me to myself.
The old servant was slung about with a capacious canvas bag into which he now began piling Ross's cast-off things. He did this hastily, almost in the manner of a burglar carrying off his swag, and this action of his brought to Ross's face an amused smile. He was tempted to say to Chesterfield that once he'd washed and pressed the shirts and undergarments, he could keep them for himself, that his despair was so complete that he really did not care if he was forced to walk about the ship naked and submit to the ridicule of having his private parts exposed to strangers. But he held back from this. It was as if he believed that remaining covered up, indeed almost invisible in his wooden hutch, he might at last construct a new person, one who had eaten all his shame and let it pass through him into a stinking pot, taken away by a man whose only vanity was to believe in himself. He asked himself how on earth this new Ross could be assembled. It came to him that if he could recall more than a scant few genuine acts of kindness in his life, then these might act as a kind of guide rail on which he could lean when the weather of self-loathing blew in. He lay in his coffin bed and tried to cover himself with a blanket of recollection. He took himself to the Wilshire lanes and woods of his childhood. He carried a butterfly net. Ahead of him, always running on ahead, and then suddenly stopping when he sighted an insect or plant which interested him, was Edmund, blithe and happy in each passing moment, an innocent whose collecting zeal brought bright blood to his cheeks and laughter to his throat. Edmund would shout instructions to him. When we reach the field, tread softly, for plovers nest on the plough. Hark when the wind rattles the gorse, for we shall find bees clinging to the flowers. Watch the sky for us, so we are not lost in the dark. And he always tried to obey his brother, and then at the end of an afternoon, guide them safely home. For it was in Edmund's nature to stray from the path, to lose his sense of direction, and more than once it was Valentine who led his brother back as dusk came on, to where their mother waited in her parlour with a lit lamp and worry in her heart for her boys. Here, surely, were acts of kindness, for which he had asked and received nothing. Neither Edmund nor their quiet mamma had ever shown gratitude towards him for guiding them safely through failing light, and yet all through his childhood, Ross had persisted in this role. And he thought now that here was something to set against shame and loathing. It also filled his heart for a brief moment with the belief that now, at last, he was once again embarked on the same mission, to be the one to bring Edmund home. This time, no fond parent waited for them. If there was a lamp burning in the house where they had once lived, it had been lit by strangers. Mother and father both lay in St. Mary's churchyard, and the graves were overgrown. But Ross thought now that if ever he survived the sea journey, if at last Edmund was found, he would ask his brother if this is what he wanted, to be brought back to the valley where they had grown up and lived chastely there, as though the intervening years had never been. As he drifted to sleep on the tide of this dreamlike thought, he said again as he had said to Chesterfield, "All I know is the past." Over the following few days, in worsening weather, as the Cape of Good Hope neared, Ross kept trying to steer his thoughts towards his childhood, looking there for acts of innocence and kindness. He'd loved his mother, and had always tried to please her, but he had also known that Edmund was the son dearest to her heart. Often Edmund would be praised or caressed in a kind of unceasing way which would cause Valentine terrible pain, but he almost never let his anguish become visible. He only strove harder to behave as his mother wished. And when she did put her arms round him or stroke his hair, he was able to bask in these moments of tenderness and congratulate himself on staying strong and hiding his jealousy of his brother. And just summoning her presence now, seeing her sewing by the parlor fire, was almost enough to bring him respite from his perpetual agitation. And yet it was not quite enough. The image of her kept slipping away from him, or else Edmund destroyed it by coming into the room and sitting at her feet. And when he did this, she laid aside her work to fondle his bright curls.
Perhaps it was this, the sight of her gentle hands entangled in Edmund's hair, that made Ross suddenly remember the emerald and diamond ring which had once belonged to his mother and which he had planned to give to Jane. And then he had left it in her room. He cursed and then cursed again. He had left it in her bedroom in Tite Street without meaning to do so and had never had a moment to recover it. The loss of this, the only thing of value he had had from his parent, now caused him intense agony. It suddenly felt to him that this had happened not because of his own forgetfulness or inattention, but because of Jane's sorcery. She was a true witch. She had inherited a fortune from her aunt, but had somehow arranged to trick him into leaving his mother's ring behind for her to add to all that she had taken from him. It was unbearable. He went in search of Chesterfield to ask him to furnish him with paper and ink. He would write a letter to Jane and post it back to England when the Queen of the Island stopped at Simonstown to take on supplies. He would accuse her of bad faith, taking the ring into her own possession when the conditions of that possession had been savagely betrayed. He would request that it be given to Sir William for safekeeping until his return with Edmund to Wiltshire. He found Chesterfield shepherding a small group of convicts round and round the deck as they enjoyed a brief respite from the dark hole in which they lived. The men wore leg irons, and Ross could see that these had so chafed the ankles that many of them had to endure the agony of weeping sores. But Chesterfield was gentle with them, exhorting them to take good gulpings of fresh air and to lift their white faces to the southern sun. And when Ross saw this, he retreated to his cabin without disturbing them. Confronted by people whose future was one of unremitting hard labor, who would never again be free, he pitied them. In these feelings of pity resided a guilty kind of joy. Chapter 61. The Middle Child. If Ireland had always been famed for the quantity of rain which fell upon it all year round, so that the bright greenness of the fields might be enough to dazzle the yellow eyes of the golden eagle, it was also true that 1 year in 10, a hot summer broke out, and the green began to fade towards dry beige, and above the hedgerows the air was a shimmering mirror. It was such a summer which began after the arrival of Clorinda Morrissey and her niece Aisling in the house of the McKinnon sisters. Above the Strand, the sky was the softest bird's egg blue, and when the sun went down over the sea, it flared such a brilliant crimson that the watchers on the shore, if they had witnessed sunsets over the Sahara Desert, might have compared it to these. In this exalted kind of weather, a delightful lethargy fell upon the house. Miss Elizabeth spent less time at her painting and more time sitting in the shade of the apple trees, dreaming of all that she and her sister might offer to the young stranger who had suddenly appeared among them. Miss Maeve put her vibrant energy into contriving ever more mouth-watering picnics for them to take to the Strand, and teaching Aisling how to press wildflowers between the pages of the McKinnon family Bible. As for Clorinda, she watched with tenderness all that was going on around her and kept asking herself the same question. Was she compelled by moral right to return Aisling to her life in Dublin? Or might she send word to Michael and Kathleen that their seemingly unwanted girl had found a new home and ask that she be allowed to stay there, at least until the summer was over? She had no answer. She wished that Sir William was with her, that she might ask his advice on the matter. Yet she also knew that this question was not his to decide. It had to be settled in the end by Michael and Kathleen and by Aisling herself. But why spoil the girl's continuing recovery from grief and rejection by asking it? She sensed that Aisling had no wish to address anything but the moment-to-moment wonders of this burning summer. She had adopted a goat she named Iris. She sat in the long grass, stroking Iris's nose and pulling softly on her long ears. She fed her apples and dandelion leaves. She addressed her as my dearest little pet. She asked Miss Maeve if they might take the donkey cart into Ennistymon and purchase a bell to hang around Iris's neck. And they went and bought the bell, and Aisling said, "Now Iris will never again be lost." Then one day, another girl appeared on the Strand. She was about Aisling's age. She was dressed in a simple linen shift, Her hair was wild.
When she saw the Mrs. McKinnon and Aisling with them, she came skipping over to where they sat under a frayed parasol. Maeve McKinnon got up and laid a kiss on the child's head.
"This is Charlotte O'Connor," she said. "Her father is a schoolteacher. And here, Charlotte, are our new friends, Mrs. Morrissey and her niece Aisling." "New friends?"